I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The Motorsport Season Review Awards, in association with Pocker 1/8 Model Kits.
Hello and welcome to part two of the Motorsport F1 Season Review podcast. I'm Damien Smith, your host, and I'm joined once again, as we were in part one, by Mark Hughes, Grand Prix editor of Motorsport magazine, and racing driver and broadcaster Alex Brundle. Mark, Alex, welcome back. Nice to see you again. We're going to crack on into the second part by picking up on the Motorsport Awards. It's that award season time. Motorsport Awards sponsored by Pocker. Now, the this is something that you want to get onto online and vote for, but the deadline closes on December the 20th, which isn't far away. So we're going to be talking about some of these awards now, and I'd urge you, once you've finished listening to us wittering on, that you go onto the website and post your vote. So let's start first with Driver of the Year. So Motorsport have nominated four drivers for this one. Max Verstappen, Lando Norris, Alex Albon, and Fernando Alonso. Now, in part one of our podcast, if you listen to that, we talked quite a lot about Verstappen, Norris and Alonso. Mark, we didn't speak so much about Alex Albon, who I thought did wonders in that Williams this year. And obviously his reputation after the Red Bull years that he had and the struggles he had has soared in this era with Williams. What did you make of Alex Albon this year?
I thought he was terrific. Yeah, he's growing as a driver, and he's now got the team sort of around him, and he's got the qualities of a leader. He's got someone that has made the team his own, and he's just very, very good at grabbing the opportunities when they come up. He can do a qualifying lap even in a car which is a little bit light on downforce, but you mask the worst effects of that with a new set of tires, and so he's quite often sort of transcended the car's natural place on the grid, which then gives him this long afternoon of defensive drive, and he's absolutely perfect in those. The way he pulled those points out of the car, and Montreal in particular, I thought was incredible, and it led the new team principal James Vowles to say he's seen a few drives of his this year that absolutely are the drives of a world champion, and I concur. I think he's operating at a very high level now.
Alex, you know, he went through such a hard time at Red Bull. He had a year out of Formula One. It looked like it was all over for him. He was racing in the DTM, you know, coming back from that kind of situation. Not many people do come back from that, get a second chance, and then take it. I mean, what did you think of him this year?
I thought he was, I concur completely. I thought he was brilliant. He's got a very acute understanding of where his car stands, but it's kind of multi-dimensional. He understands where it stands amidst the full grid. And I think that's led into some of the sort of what we might call a bit of a Hail Mary strategy play, that they throw the car up the field and then he's able to defend. You know, he understands when that moment is that he needs to be able to strike. And I think an understanding, particularly if you're going to go and drive a car like that Williams, which was generally, not always, but generally the quicker car in the speed trap, and then having a bit more of a struggle in the high speed corner. If you're going to go and drive a car like that Williams, which is sort of slightly left field in terms of its group of assets and liabilities, if you like, in comparison to the rest of the field, you've got to be able to understand where you can use those assets in the car to be able to achieve the result. I think he's very much a thinking driver. He's a deep thinker, which is why I think sometimes Red Bull didn't suit him that much, because it would be very easy in that scenario to think much too hard about things. But I think him being a deep thinker has led to him being an asset for Williams in their sort of slightly different approach to car design and development.
Now, I'm going to put you both on the spot here slightly. Motorsports Driver of the Year nominations on the website, Verstappen, Norris, Albon or Alonso. Which ones would you go for? One of those four or someone else? Let's start with you, Alex, as we're talking to you now. What would you, who would you say was your driver of the year?
Verstappen's the easy choice, so I think we'll avoid that with the acknowledgement that it was a year of incredible performance from him. To try to pick an incisive, an interesting choice, Alonso is the clear standout amongst the other three for me in terms of a pure driving performance of him set against what he had underneath him. For me, Alonso stands out. Then after that, I think Norris, then Albon. Again, amongst the rest of the field, outstanding performances. But within those three that are non-champion drivers of the year, I would pick Alonso as my standout in terms of a pure driving performance.
Okay. And Mark, I know how much you love these binary choices of rating people. Who would you go for if I put a gun to your head? Who would it be?
It'd be churlish to go for anybody other than Verstappen, because he did reach new levels of performance. Even though he was in the fastest car, but there were some races where he took that and stretched that advantage outrageously. And I'm thinking of Spa and Suzuka and places like that. And there were also races where it wasn't that easy to stick it on pole and win the race, because it had traits. It was a little bit reluctant to get the front tire temperature, for example. And there were races where if you didn't get pole and you didn't lead in the first corner, you probably weren't going to win it. And he still, on those tracks, he still managed to do that. And I think, you know, he wasn't often, you didn't often see him have to give everything of himself. But when you did, like in Sector 3 in Monaco qualifying, when Fernando had done that great time, for example, it was all there. And I think this was a great driver, able to really get everything out of himself because he had a car that enabled him to do that. And he was instrumental in helping develop that car into what it was. So, like I say, it would be churlish for it to be anybody other than Verstappen for me.
Now, as we move on to Team of the Year, it occurred to me that you've witnessed Formula One domination through different eras. So, the Schumacher-Ferrari era, Red Bull again with Vettel and those four consecutive titles that he took, and then the Mercedes era. And I think one of the things I've always taken from these times is there's a sense that, there's a privilege to seeing great sportsmen at the top of their game, great teams working at their height. And there's actually a pleasure to be taken from that. Would you agree with that? And how do you think this era compares to some of those others in terms of what we're seeing at the moment?
I do agree with that. I do. It's quite a privilege to be watching history being made. And they definitely felt that during the Schumacher eras, the Mercedes eras, the two now Red Bull eras. And how it compares, it's very different. The sport's very different. We've seen it happen during the tyre war year. We've seen it happen during the Bridgestone control tyre era. We've seen it happen in the Pirelli era. And they all make, and the different regulations all place different sets of demands and make the critical path to the end outcome different. And so, it's never the same story. The outcomes might look similar, but the stories are quite different. So that's the fascination for me.
Alex, now on this subject of Team of the Year, Motorsports have put down four suggestions. Red Bull, obviously, McLaren, Aston Martin, and Williams as an interesting choice. So we've talked a little bit about Alex Albon. Which of those four teams or another team would you pick out as your team of the year in terms of what they've managed to achieve this year?
Again, it's as Mark kind of correctly says about the driver of the year, not it's a game of points, isn't it? And not selecting the dominant victors is always going to be a slightly outlandish choice. With that acknowledged, and I do like the forum of a podcast, because you can rather than the written word, you can kind of make that clear rather than having it blasted as a headline across the Alex Brundle says across the top. with that acknowledged, I think what McLaren have done this year is rather outstanding, actually, in terms of where they began. Yes, okay, it's a bit of a set piece. You know, it's a bit of a kind of pre-staged appreciation of performance, isn't it? Because they started the year knowing that they had the option to improve the car, knowing that there was a second line of inquiry to go down, and then they just had to convert that. But even still, you know, in terms of where they were at the beginning of the year, versus where they are at the end of the year, they're a clear standout performer for me, so I would choose them. What is impressive about Red Bull is I would call it claustrophobic dominance, really, in that they were continually ahead, but often it wasn't by much, particularly in qualifying, particularly in certain races. So that was impressive. But I do think, you know, to take a full view of the season, I would pick out McLaren as an interesting choice.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think there's definitely a case to be made for McLaren. I think one team that there's a case not to be made for, I'll be amazed if anyone votes them, is Alpine, which finished sixth in the constructors' title, a distant sixth. Williams was seventh, nowhere near them. So they had this sort of like little oasis of sixthness in the championship this year. Mark, can we just touch on Alpine, because they're not the team of the year patently, but what on earth went wrong there this year?
Yeah, a lot of strife going on there at a managerial level, and I think it was just basically a mismatch between what sort of a corporate level had been promised by the you know, the race team, and what was delivered. And so Luca de Meo felt that he had to wield the axe, and he did. And there were lots of casualties. Looking at they had a few chaotic weekends operationally, but looking at the car itself, it's about a second off the pace of Red Bull. They feel that half a second of that is the power unit, and half a second was the chassis. The chassis was a little bit light on traction, had poor ride. They couldn't run it as low as they'd hoped. The power unit is, it's the fourth fastest of the four power units, and they'd asked for a holiday from the engine freeze, but from the FIA, but were turned down. So, add those two things together, and there's your second deficit. It doesn't take very much. I think it's just that mismatch of ambition and reality, which ended up being very, very damaging and left a lot of blood on the walls. And you really hope that they can sort of just do a reset and rebuild from there. Given that the car itself was a disaster, but it's not what they aspire to be as a factory team.
Yeah, and they seem to be the ownership structure there, and the board don't seem to be very patient. So you feel like they're running on a clock at that team. Alex, in terms of the drivers at Alpine, they're an interesting pairing. Obviously, they've got some history between them. They're not exactly best buds. What did you make of Pierre Gasly and Esteban Ocon this year?
They've got to get those two kind of pushing in the same direction, haven't they? They seem to be endlessly chirping away on the radio. When you hear that on the radio, you know, I can't believe you let the other car undercut me. How have we operated this strategy? Why is he doing that? Again, this guy, blah, blah, blah. You always know that you can turn the volume up to about 10 if that volume is one, as soon as they get back to the bus and start chatting away with each other. Now, it's not imperative that racing drivers in the same team are best mates. You know, we've seen racing teams function perfectly successfully with two drivers operating at arm's length. And actually, sometimes, you know, two drivers being too friendly with each other across the garage can be detrimental, especially if they start to kind of complete a rear guard action against the ownership structure. But I think those two are at a position where it must be detrimental to the development of the car, which could well be a factor. Add in a little bit of a straight line speed deficit, to which is one of the most frustrating things to race with, and you've got a pair of angry racing drivers who don't really like each other. It's a bit of a problem soup, isn't it? And they've got to sort that out for you next year.
Yeah, I do worry for Alpine. Let's see where they go next. Let's move on to race of the year. Motorsports Awards, as I say, is the deadline's coming up, December the 20th. So get online and post your votes. Sponsored by Pocker Models. It's an annual debate about Driver of the Year, Team of the Year, Race of the Year. Now, Mark, I wonder what's your favourite race of the year that you enjoyed so much when you were getting into analysing what you'd seen and getting into the detail. The races that Motorsport had picked out were Zandvoort, Monza, Singapore, Las Vegas, first Las Vegas Grand Prix, obviously a big landmark. But for you, which one did you take most pleasure from?
I did enjoy all those, actually. I think if I had to nominate one, it would be Vegas, because, you know, there was such an unusual circuit, Monza-type speeds in between walls. We say they got a bit of Jeddah as well, but that was quite spectacular. But also just the way that it worked out with the track surface and the combination of that and the temperatures. Everyone was able to go flat out pretty much, and we did get a proper race, and the outcome was in doubt for quite a while. And for me, it was that. It was spectacular, but it was it was successful as an event, a big occasion. But it was surprisingly, I thought it was successful also as a sport, as a sporting event, and I think that. It showed F1 to advantage there.
Yeah, Alex, let's talk about Vegas a little bit more, because what a bizarre weekend from start to finish, really, with a terrible start with the drain cover coming loose and spectators having to be evicted from grandstands, team bosses getting cross about the reaction, and lots of bad tempers. Verstappen seeming to have nothing good to say about the place until he'd won the race itself. And then it all turned around with that terrific Grand Prix. What did you make of it?
There are a couple of factors early on in the weekend. I think a lot of the negative comments about it, firstly, I think they were very lucky that sort of manhole cover or a water cover incident has happened at other circuits before. Because if that was the first time that ever, which it isn't by a long shot, if that was the first time that had ever happened at a Formula One Grand Prix, they may well have closed the event down there and then. I think, though, a lot of the negative comments around that were burnout more than anything from the length of the season. I mean, you look at the attitude of the individuals, you look at the way that team representatives press conference played out, the comments from Toto, the comments from Fred Vasseur, obviously just lost a car in free practice, and then the comments from Max Verstappen. There are a lot of tired, very, very tired individuals by the time we got to the beginning of that weekend. It needed to be a wildly good Grand Prix, and in terms of spectacle, you know, in terms of an action spectacle for somebody who's watching Formula One in the same way as I watch boxing, where I would turn it on and I don't know who's who or necessarily beyond the really big names, it was clearly the best of the year for me. You know, to watch a race without requiring depth of insight in terms of pure action, Vegas was fantastic. They grabbed a great victory from the jaws of defeat there. And I think a different in a different calendar, it would have been an even bigger victory with key personnel feeling better about arriving there, having not been quite so heavily involved in the sport for so many weekends on the trot.
Yeah. Alex's point there, Mark, about how tired everyone was and the fatigue that was kicking in at that time of year. You've been on the Grand Prix trail now for more than 20 years. It's a tough old life for everyone who works in the sport. This year, 22 races, should have been 23 if Imola had happened. Obviously, that was cancelled because of the weather that hit the region at that time of year. Next year, 24 races. Are we at saturation point, do you think?
Oh, for sure. We're straddling that line. And that really, you know, the teams are talking about having different crews to do it. And that's probably how it's going to have to be done. But squeezing more in, you know, doing 5 Grand Prix and 6 weekends as we did back end of the season, nobody's functioning very well. No. Whether it be in the paddock, in the car, in the media set, it's too much. It is too much.
I do wonder as well, they all seem to blend into each other after a while because this is coming at you incessantly every weekend. Is there a fear, Mark, that the value of a Grand Prix is becoming less because of the number of races? Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a danger in terms of the perception from the outside. You know, from the inside, it's from a business perspective, it's very easy to say, well, let's squeeze more and more in and let's make more and more money. But there does come a point where you will begin to damage the brand, and then that does long term. That does have an impact financially. So I think they need to tread quite carefully.
And Alex, one of the things that, let's look at this from a positive perspective, we're not losing the traditional venues here with these new races such as Vegas and Jeddah in the last couple of years. We've got a good mix of these new modern fast street circuits and then the traditional venues. Do you like that? The fact that we're keeping... keeping the Monzas, the Silverstones, the Suzukas?
I think you can't lose those key venues. They're a core of the sport. It's great to go there. It's great to... and also, you know, from a driver's perspective, it's nice for the rookie drivers and the drivers who are coming from other series to have at least a few circuits they might know on the Formula One calendar, because there are so many F1-specific or F1 calendar-specific venues now that it almost ends up being very disconnected from the rest of motorsport if you're not careful. The other thing I would point out, you know, and if you take it away from, if you're less sort of supplier focused and more customer focused for a second, I agree with everything that Mark said about the stress on people who are delivering these events. We're not seeing badly attended Formula One races, are we?
No.
You know? It's not like, well, there was one last week and nobody's bothered coming to this one because it's in a similar region and they've traveled. The viewer numbers are great. Formula One's as big as it's ever been. People are watching these races and people are going to them. So to say from a viewer's perspective, I understand from a supplier's perspective, and there's a limit on what can feasibly be done. But the reason why more races are being added is because they're saleable races and people will watch them and people will go.
Now, Alex, you also commentate on Formula 2 and Formula 3, and you were mentioning there about young drivers at least having some circuits that are familiar to them. I mean, it's never been easy or taken for granted coming into Formula 1. Everything always has come at you much faster in every sense. What do you think it's like for young drivers, such as Logan Sargeant, for example, coming in this year, facing what he's had to face?
It's and I said this when drivers were jumping out of Formula One cars in FP1 back into their Formula Two cars in Abu Dhabi. There are a decent number of them. And it's so close in terms of its proximity in the viewer's perception out of a Formula Two car into a Formula One car. It's on the same track. They look so similar as racing machines because they're intended to. I think that is the biggest jump that a racing car driver ever makes since they stopped karting and jumped in a car. The difference in total downforce, the difference in power, the difference in complexity of systems between a Formula One car and a Formula Two car, mainly for cost reasons, is absolutely vast. Add to that the multiple different. Well, you look, you've got 14 races, so there are going to be at least 10 circuits you've never seen unless you've gone and raced somewhere else. It's a huge ask alongside everything that goes on with the media obligations triple, quadruple as soon as you're in an F1 car. So yeah, that's a vast challenge, and anything we can do to give those drivers the opportunity to perform straight away. And equally, you know, we've seen so many Formula 2 drivers over the last couple of years. Felipe Drugovich, Oscar Piastri had to wait a year. Looks like Teo Pourchaire is going to have to wait a year as well. We need to do things to give Formula 1 teams confidence that these young drivers are going to be able to do it. And having similar venues and similar cars and similar processes are those things, in my view.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Now, of course, it's one thing coming in at the start of a season. Mark, let's just talk about Liam Lawson at AlphaTauri coming in to step in for the injured Daniel Ricciardo, who himself had come in to replace Nick de Vries mid-season because Nick had performed lower than expectations. What did you make of Lawson, first of all, in terms of the job that he did stepping in after Zandvoort?
I thought he was terrific. Thrown in at the real deep end at Zandvoort in a wet track, just staying on the track and finishing the race was impressive, given that he'd not been in the car at all. But then he started, the next few races, he started really showing well and delivering some impressive performances to the extent that he had a sort of start-to-finish scrap with Yuki Tsunoda throughout the Japanese Grand Prix and came out ahead at the end. And, I think he's definitely done enough to warrant a place of, okay, there's no slot from immediately, but I would be surprised if it hasn't been enough to get him on the grid at some point next year and maybe for a full season the year after.
And Mark, sticking with you, what's your verdict on Ricciardo? I mean, everyone was very pleased to see him back. Mm-hmm. Because he's a great character and very popular guy. Did he do as much as you would have liked to see from him? Or
no, I'd like to have seen a bit more, but obviously he was curtailed a little bit by his injury. He wasn't conclusively faster than Yuki Tsunoda, and I think the expectation would be if you're going to go into the Red Bull alongside Max Verstappen, you would want him to be at somewhere the level that he had been when he was last at Red Bull, when he wasn't that far away from Max. So, I think we need to see a little bit more, but he certainly looks on a good trajectory, and he looks like he's coming out of the bottom of the curve that he'd got into at McLaren. And, the feedback from inside the time when he first came back on the simulator was that he was, you know, he was miles away. He was nothing like what he'd left. He came back as a completely different drive to the one who'd left.
Yeah.
But he made good progress. And at the test he did at Silverstone, the one that got him into the AlphaTauri, was by all accounts very impressive. So, yeah, we all want to see him back, but we all want to see the proper Daniel back. And I think we got glimpses of it, and he put the thing P4 on the grid in Mexico, which was impressive. But by the same token, Yuki wasn't doing a serious lap that day. He had a power unit penalty, so it was just his only role really was to tow Daniel to get through Q1 and Q2. So we didn't have a direct comparison there when the car was working really well. But yeah, I think we've seen something, and that we should be looking forward to seeing how he performs in the new year.
And Alex, in terms of the last thing on AlphaTauri, that at the end of the season there was a bit of a kerfuffle about how much they were drawing from Red Bull in terms of the final upgrade, and they had that lift up the championship above Alfa Romeo and Haas. But really, I mean, we've seen it all before, haven't we? It's nothing. There's nothing particularly new there with this this situation with a team owned by the same company, two teams owned by the same company. What did you make of that? Was that a problem?
You obviously it generates the whole cost cap and aerodynamic limitation scenario doesn't really fit with the sister team scenario, does it? They're kind of mutually incompatible, because you've got to consider these teams as lone entities. Otherwise, it's very hard to judge them with regards to those things. So, yeah, I mean, how much of a strategy are you allowed to put in place to you know, and even, you know, considerations in terms of developments borrowed, developments shared between engine manufacturers and so on and so forth, driver movement. It's the whole thing is very wishy-washy in terms of who gets to use what. But for me, yeah, I'm interested in the sport. That's down for the accountants to sort out, and we'll watch them race on track. I care about which one outbreak the other one. And in the end, they have the cars they have.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of the last two teams on the grid, Alfa Romeo, Sauber, now bizarrely named Stake F1, but Alfa Romeo as it was in 2023, and Haas, we had two teams here that every now and again would pop into Q3 with their drivers doing great efforts in qualifying. Both then tended to slip back in the races. I also wanted to ask you about these two teams in the context of another team coming in, whether they're, you know, this 11th team, Andretti Cadillac. Really, is there, if a new team comes in, can they expect to do anything more than what Alfa Romeo and Haas are doing? Mark, let's start with you first on this one, because really, you're on a bit of a hiding to nothing, aren't you?
Oh, I think to come in at a good level, doing everything on your own, other than the power unit, I think you're gonna struggle initially. But there's, if you're serious about it and you're prepared to invest in it, there's no reason why you can't begin to make progress. And it depends how long you want to commit to it. But yeah, you're coming in at this is a very, very high level, so it should be difficult. And I don't see that there's a problem with that in itself. And I don't think Andretti would be coming in expecting to be, you know, being competitive immediately, and if they do, it wouldn't be realistic.
Yeah, what's your view, Alex? I mean, would you welcome Andretti into the sport?
I think that having a further team in the sport with, particularly with an American flag under the name, would be beneficial to the sport. Actually, I don't see any reason from the fans' perspective where a competitive team wouldn't add something. I understand the argument from the current teams, and I'm not one of these guys that sits back and just says, these guys are being greedy. These guys are just trying to make money. These guys just don't want to divide the pie, because I can understand not wanting to divide the pie. You know, you're part of a sport that has grown exponentially. You've all taken your capital at risk, and you've all played your role in that. So why should those? You know, it needs to be an acceptable deal to the parties currently involved. I think that's going to be very hard to navigate, frankly. But from the perspective of a neutral fan who talks about it to people on the television, more the merrier. You know, from our perspective watching home. I do mirror, though, what Mark says, and I've found this a couple of times on with new startup teams. There are two rules I've learned when somebody's asked me to be involved with a startup team. Happened to me most recently in LMP1 at Le Mans. The first one is, if you've got enough money and time, the pure resources of racing, money and time, then eventually you'll be successful. But the amount of money and time that you need are normally exponentially more than the entity expects. So that will always happen, but it tends to happen a hell of a lot slower than they think it's going to happen, which I think would be true of an Andretti Cadillac coming in.
Yeah. And of course, there is another big entity on its way. We've still got a bit of time to wait until Audi joined the grid in 2026. Mark, we mentioned Alfa Romeo, now Sauber, now Stake F1, whatever they want to call themselves. It's still Sauber to us. What do you make of that team at the moment? Because, you know, Audi have recently said they're definitely coming. There's no doubts about that. The board are committed to it. But there's this sort of feeling that almost that they're treading water until that era actually begins. What's going on there?
The structure of the deal is complicating a little bit because Audi are buying into it in stages. So they're still a minority shareholder at the moment. So the majority shareholder is still Finn Rousing. So, he's the business guy that rescued it from bankruptcy. If it requires new investment to scale up, obviously there's going to be a reluctance from the minority shareholder who's soon going to be, out of there altogether. He's not going to want to spend his own money on something for the future. So there is a little bit of a mismatch there, because ideally, if Audi's coming in 2026, it needs to be making the big investments now to get, to recruit and to get the facilities to where they need them to be. But that's it's a good, solid, competent Formula One team. It's got a fantastic wind tunnel. It's got some good people there. There's nothing wrong with it in its foundation, and it's a really solid platform on which to build a manufacturer's F1 program. But it's in this transition period, it's a slightly awkward place. So the outcome is as we've seen. It's a penultimate place on the grid. It's not that far between. The front of the grid and the back of the grid is an average over the season is 1.3 seconds. So you're not a million miles away, even at the back. And there'll be, if you look at a GPS trace of an Alfa Romeo qualified by Valtteri Bottas and a Red Bull qualified by Max Verstappen, you'll see on certain corners Valtteri's quicker there and he's quicker. So that's the level that you're at, and that's why it would be very, very difficult for any new team coming in. But I think in this sort of 2 year period before it's Audi, but after it's Alfa Romeo, it's a little bit awkward, really.
Yeah, it's a good point. And margins are so fine. Alex, in terms of Valtteri Bottas, I'd like to ask you about directly about him. He's at an interesting stage of his career. He's come out of the big championship winning team. It seems like he's on the downslope of his Formula One career, but do you think he can realistically expect to hang in there long enough to be around and to lead the team when Audi come in?
I'm not sure. From his perspective, he had a lot of option, honestly, other than to take what was offered to him. I mean, the drivers in that team are in exactly the same position as the team are. They're waiting around and kind of treading water for hopefully that investment. The biggest concern that I would have as Valtteri is, what is, even if I do make it all the way until that investment comes, if it comes, when it comes, we're assuming that they go for it, what's going to be the degradation of the team and my reputation in the interim without the investment to be effective at the front of the field? And even if I do make it to 2026, will they look at me as their current driver, who to the eye of any ownership structure has been effectively underperforming for years, and replace me there and then? Who are the incumbent, you know, favourites for Audi? And will they want somebody else entirely behind the wheel of the car? So the short answer to your question is, I don't think either of those drivers can rely on being A, making it that far, or B, being retained if they do, which I think will be the more difficult challenge, frankly.
Mm. Yeah, it could be interesting. It could be a real opportunity for someone else when the Audi era starts. I always have this feeling that Audi will want a clean slate when they do finally come in, which may not play too well for Bottas. But what a great character he is on the grid, particularly these days. He seems to be free from the shackles of being a number two at Mercedes to Lewis Hamilton, which is how he was perceived, whether that's fair or not. And he's found his voice in terms of the stuff he gets up to on social media. He seems to be enjoying life, doesn't he, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think he does. The calendars are hilarious, aren't they? And the general postings are hilarious. It'll still be hurting, though, that they're a little bit anonymous weekend after weekend. It's hard to really find... That team also really misses a voice in the paddock. A lot of the kind of the key engineering personnel are a little bit media shy. There's no Fred Vasseur, Toto Wolff voice focal front character of the team, which means that they kind of get lost in terms of their message a little bit as well. Valtteri's having fun. He's picking up a not inconsequential check, I would imagine, as well, which doesn't hurt. But he will be thinking about better days when he had the opportunity to win Grand Prix, for sure.
Yeah. Now, we're in the final minutes of our two-part Motorsport Season Review podcast. I just want to touch briefly with both of you on the politics, which has been, this year, it's been fairly stable, actually. We haven't had too much bubbling up and causing too much controversy, but there's a lot of tension on a number of different levels we've seen between the FIA and Formula One, and obviously the promoter Liberty Media. Mark, is this something we should be worried about, this situation?
Probably not long term, but you know, these things always tend to get settled after a few blows are exchanged, and we're coming up to the negotiation for the 2026 Concorde Agreement, which is when all the way and the money is split and the way the sport is run is all, you know, put down and signed up to. So there's an element of that. The last time it happened was when Liberty bought the sport, and during that time the FIA got a chunk lot more money from F1, but lost some a little bit of control. And the current president is unhappy with both the level of control and the money. So I think there's probably a bit of horse trading going on. And that's why there's the occasional hand grenade gets dropped. And I think that's, you have to see through the various news stories through that prism. There is an element of negotiation to it.
And Alex, do you like what you see in Grand Prix racing at the moment? Is Formula One in a good place?
I think Formula One's in a great place. I love the way that the sport is reaching a new audience. I think that it's our job as the sport to convert that audience from fans of the show to fans of the sport. And that's what I sort of actively try to do, perhaps by chopping it up a little bit and serving it a bit more slowly. And I think that the sport's got to continue to change and evolve, and as always, as it always used to be, when these moments, slightly inconsequential moments in many ways, although they seem moments of consequence at the time, come out, it helps to build noise around the sport. But fundamentally, I think it's a great product on track. I don't buy into the Verstappen one everything. That's boring. I still watch Formula One racing, and even if it wasn't my job to be involved with it and commentate on it from a driver's perspective, I would watch every minute of Formula One racing that occurred in a year. And it's fabulous to see it in such a good place.
I'm sure everyone listening to this would probably agree with you on that, Alex. It's no matter how much it infuriates us at times, we can't take our eyes off it, can we? It's just a great sport.
You know, everybody who said they would never watch ever a Formula One race again after whatever it is that last annoyed them occurred, and then tuned in the next Friday. Don't worry, there are a lot of other people doing the same. That's just passion, isn't it? That's just passion for the sport.
Sounds like a perfect note to finish on. So Mark Hughes, Alex Brundle, thank you so much for your company. Really enjoyed talking to you today. Just let me remind you before we sign off. So the Motorsport Awards, it's that awards time of the year, sponsored by Pocker. You can go online and vote for Driver of the Year, Race of the Year, Team of the Year. There's also Photograph of the Year. We didn't discuss that here because it's not great for audio listening, really, talking about Best Picture of the Year, but that's all on the website. Please do go online. The deadline is December the 20th, so it's not far off. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next season.
The Motorsport Season Review Awards, in association with Pocker 1/8 Model Kits.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.